Welcome to Resiliency Redefined. I'm your host, Robin, and I am thrilled to share with you information about resiliency, well-being, performance, education, business, parenting, and everything in between. I'm committed to joining you each week to talk about these big ideas and bring them into action, habits, tools, strategies, tactics that allow us to finally uncover what it takes to truly be well. And I'm just so excited that you're here. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Resiliency Redefined. I'm so excited to dive into today's big idea. So someone reached out and said, Robin, I want to know more about how do I break a bad habit? Like, how do I break a habit that is no longer serving me? So I'm happy to dive into that question and share with you some key learnings on that. Before we go into that, though, I do just want to let you know I am on the tail end of a wee bit of a cold, so I might sound a wee bit stuffy, and I kind of pushed it to the like last possible moment to be able to record this without sounding like a slobbery mess. So then that way we would still be able to have an episode this week. So this is like the best I can possibly sound in light of bouncing back from a pretty grip of this cold that didn't want to let go. But I'm definitely on the other end of it. So I apologize if I sound kind of snotty and gross. I'm doing my best, but okay, here we go. Speaking of habits, so as a behaviorist, somebody who was trained as somebody in the behavioral sciences and then went on into psychology and education, I love talking about habits because it's something that this is a big belief that I hold. The habits make up the quality of your life. Your habits make up the quality of your life. I have said that for decades. The type of habits that you engage in will let us know the quality of the life that you are living. Either those habits are getting you closer to your goals, or those habits will get you farther away from your goals. So to dive into this, I think it's really helpful to say, okay, well, what actually is a habit? A habit is a behavior that you have repeated to the point or have enough reps in with that behavior that essentially it starts to feel rather automatic. It's not quite necessarily that you've experienced mastery, but there's just almost like this autopilot effect. Now, there's some research that suggests almost 60% of the behaviors that we engage in on a daily basis are subconscious or on autopilot. However, what we do know is that there's so much wiggle room in there to be able to like really imagine and work with our habits in ways, again, that either help us or hinder us. So again, this behavior is a behavior, whatever the behavior is, that has been repeated so frequently that it becomes just really familiar. And again, we talked about in our last episode that myelin sheathing creates this like fatty substance. So that way that neuron can travel very quickly and get to where it needs to go in terms of behavior. Now, another component of habits that we haven't talked about before is the ABC model. This is like classic behaviorism, which means that the A stands for an antecedent. Something happens first, then we're going to have a behavior, and then there'll be a consequence. ABC, antecedent, behavior, and consequence. So when we're thinking about habit formation, there has to be a trigger. There has to be a starting point. There has to be something that creates the experience, and then it will execute the behavior or will enact the behavior or facilitate the behavior, whatever it is, and there's going to be a consequence. And depending on the consequence, it's going to help really strengthen that behavior. Or again, if it's a very negative consequence, it will like essentially we can cancel out a behavior. So what does all this have to do with how do we break a bad habit? Well, I think it's also helpful to just take a moment to tease out the difference between a habit and addiction or an obsession. So an addiction was once a habit that developed a component of what we call this like compulsiveness. Meaning that at one point it was a habit. We were doing it, we were repeating it, we were repeating it. But then somewhere in that behavioral kind of repertoire, it becomes compulsive that we feel like we don't have control of it anymore. And whether that be craving, whether that be this kind of idea that if we're not doing the habit, we get really restless, we start to feel really agitated. And that's not just from a physiological perspective that we have this like chemical dependence on something. It's also a psychological dependency. So it goes in tandem. There's this physiological reaction that our body thinks it needs this thing. So there's this compulsion. And also psychologically, we get really focused on that thing. So when we're looking at, for example, supporting persons who've navigated addictions, it's going to look quite different than when we're talking about the habits and, shifting our habits when we're talking about things like perhaps, not doing as much mindless scrolling. Now, that isn't the same as somebody who is minimizing or giving up alcohol or drugs or other things that have a physiological underpinning to it. So I just don't want to minimize the experience for people who've experienced or have navigated addictions. And sometimes I do get a wee bit concerned that people think that they're just like really strong, big habits. There's far more to addictions. And as somebody who has navigated addictions, simplifying it in terms of just saying it's a bad habit, that doesn't feel very good because unless you've been in that experience and know what that is like, you can't simplify that. You can't just chalk it up to willpower or motivation. There's far greater factors at play. So, addiction leads into this piece around compulsiveness, a compulsion. Physiologically, psychologically, there's more at play. And it is so complicated. Okay. So, the reason I want to just hold space for that is while we're going to talk about habits, we're not going to interchange the word habit and addiction because we hold addiction in a different space. Again, because it's something that requires enormous amounts of support, intervention, understanding, also grace, a lot of mercy, and, a lot of forgiveness sometimes. So we're going to leave that by itself over here. And if you want to hear more about addictions, we can talk about that another day. But today, we're going to talk about the habits. All right, so we have this antecedent, or we call a trigger. We have this behavior, and then we have a consequence. So when we think about, first of all, this idea of, quote, a good habit or a bad habit, I don't think it's a moral issue. Okay, so when I hear people say, oh, Robin, I was so bad last night, and I'm like, oh my gosh, did you punch a kitten? And they're like, no, I had cookies. Okay, wow. When people tell me they've been really bad and morally bad, like I'm thinking they've done something like punched a kitten. I am not thinking that you had that extra cupcake. So we're going to first just kind of take out that piece around habits and morality because this is not a moral issue. This is a behavioral issue. It is a behavior that either is getting reinforced or it is getting punished, and we either continue to do it or we decrease it depending on the schedule of reinforcement or punishment. Okay, so not a moral issue. So next time you feel tempted to say, oh, I was so bad last night, or I cheated last night, and I had, heaven forbid, carbohydrates, even though we know carbohydrates literally fuels your brain. When people tell me they're going low carb, I get so nervous because it's like, this is what your brain needs to function. Please stop giving carbohydrates such a bad reputation. It is not what is making you so unwell. Anyway, I'm sorry, I digress. Your body needs carbohydrates, my friend. Anyway, so it's not a moral issue. Here we go. When we think about good or bad habits, again, we're not going to do that because it's not good or bad. It's this idea of what habit is either serving you in terms of getting you closer to your goal or what habit is getting you farther away. And what really starts to impact this, we've touched on it just briefly already, is this idea of the schedule of reinforcement. So the reason why, for example, working out is very hard for many of us to develop a habit to do consistently is because it is uncomfortable. It hurts. The next morning when you wake up and can't even put your own hair in a ponytail, or you can't even walk down a flight of stairs, that does not send us all of the cues that this is something we should keep doing. Okay. So the immediacy of the discomfort of a workout It makes sense why many of us will avoid doing that because it doesn't feel good. What we know about habits is that there's a degree, this idea that it's really like it's obvious, right? But also there's like an attractiveness to it that we enjoy it. It feels good. And so even if we take the behavior like scrolling on your phone, like even though it's low effort and low reward, ultimately it's serving a purpose. There's something about it that is reinforcing. Even though after you've scrolled perhaps mindlessly for an hour and then you start shaming yourself and you start like feeling really guilty, the reality is while you are doing it on some level, it feels pretty good. You're getting that dirty digital dopamine in that scrolling behavior. But perhaps what it's doing for you is that maybe you're looking for connection. And that's one of the things I get nervous about when people get so mad at people who are like scrolling at nighttime. You know, they're not doing it necessarily because they're just, these morally inferior beings. No, like maybe they're looking for connection. They want somebody out there who understands what they're going through, right? Somebody out there who maybe is, stick handling, a really difficult boss or, is looking for motivation or is just looking for, understanding to be seen, right? We scroll because we're looking for something, right? And sometimes it might be the cat video, right? We're just looking for an interrupt. We're looking for something that's like fun and different than all of the adulting that we are doing on a daily basis. So the reason why putting down the phone, for example, is so hard, and we've chatted about this before. It's, we don't know when the reinforcement is going to come. So yes, it's minimizing the noise and maybe the, it's a bit of procrastination behavior, but the idea is it's serving a wee bit of a purpose. So when we look at how do we change our behavior, we want to look at the type of behavior we're doing. What triggers the behavior? How is this behavior being reinforced? So again, I gave the example of working out, right? Going to the gym, working out, it's hard, it's inconvenient, it's often there's a lot of discomfort, or perhaps you forgot your headphones, so you can't even watch your favorite show or listen to your favorite music or your podcast when you're there. So it all of a sudden feels like, oh, there's so many little pieces that go into trying to have a successful workout, right? So I get it, it is hard. So if we're thinking about how do we find different ways of building habits that serve us, well, I think it starts with this idea of creating habits and practices that are so simple and that they're so small that we like can't screw them up. Okay, so I'll say that again. I want a new habit that you want to create or think about to be so simple that it's like almost like impossible to screw it up. Like you're literally going to set your environment that this is just, there's an ease to it. So there's kind of four principles that we talk about in terms of building positive, in terms of positive as in additive, not positive as in moral, additive behaviors. So positive means we're adding something. It's the idea that we want to make it really obvious. What is the habit that we want to increase? We want to make it easy. We also want to make it like satisfying so that when we do it, we're like, oh, this feels good. And again, there wants to be this element of it being attractive to us, that it's like, it's worthwhile. It's something that will serve us. Okay. So if we think about the schedule, the behavior, making it so simple that we cannot fail, one of the first practices we talk about is setting up the environment. So that way, again, it's obvious and the trigger or the reminder is just already there. So, going out for a walk first thing in the morning, we know that is one of the most remarkable health benefits that you can experience. We know getting 7,000 steps a day decreases all-cause mortality by 60%. Just getting out and moving first thing in the morning, getting that great sunlight, even if it's cloudy, you're still going to get some of that vitamin D. All of these things are so good for our nervous system. Well, how do you make that so simple you cannot fail? Like, have yourself already ready the night before. Having your shoes and your coat at the door, right? Ensuring that you have enough time first thing in the morning. So that will be something that you're able to do, right? So creating the pattern that this is what I'm going to do. So we have the intention, we make it obvious. And as soon as we are pointing ourselves in the direction of that habit that we want to increase, I would really love for you to dial up your positive self-talk and already start enjoying the habit while you are even in the direction of moving towards it. So as soon as you wake up and you, let's say you've decided you're going to go for that morning walk, as soon as you get up and you're conscious, I want you to start giving yourself so much praise. You're like, oh, we're going for our walk this morning. We get to go for our walk this morning. We don't want to say, I have to go for a walk. No, this is a privilege. We get to get up and we get to go for a walk. We get to be outdoors. We get to be part of, this practice of this collective movement of people who have this non-negotiable of going for their morning walk. Natalie Davison, one of my friends, my fearless friend out in the East Coast, Canada, she posts it all the time when she's going out for a walk. She invites other people to share. They've gone out for their walk before. This is great momentum building. So again, as soon as you are pointing in that direction that you're going to go for a walk, start that narrative versus once I get through it, then I can check it off the list, right? Like I want you to enjoy the process of it. And the other kind of gentle piece around that idea of having this consistent practice of, again, let's just use going out for a walk in the morning. What the research shows is the number one way to improve your self-esteem, to improve your self-efficacy and your confidence. This variable, it's so fascinating, and I wish everybody would know this. The number one way to improve your self-esteem, be a person who does what they say they're going to do. Number one way to build self-trust, self-confidence, you are a person who does what they say they're going to do. So even that piece of information, knowing that me being a person who does what I say I'm going to do is going to improve my self-esteem, my self-confidence, my self-trust, my self-reliance. That in itself has like gotten me out the door some days, even when I don't feel like it. Okay. Because I'm anchoring it to a deep core belief. Now, again, how we also strengthen these habits has to do with our identity. How do we see ourselves? I'm somebody who sees myself as somebody who follows through and is somebody who appreciates being able to go outside and get movement first thing in the day. So again, it's part of our identity. And I shared this on an earlier episode. There was amazing research that was done that talked about the power of identity as it relates to habits. And there is a wee little piece about addiction here. So again, I just want to hold space that we've already kind of put a little asterisk around that. But they were looking at smoking behavior and smoking sensation by reducing the intake of cigarette smoke. And what they did is they put people in two different groups. One group was told and identified as a group who are, as of this moment, are no longer smokers. You are a non-smoker. And the other group in the smoking cessation group was identified as a group who is trying to quit, a group that is reducing the repetition of cigarette engagement in a day. Okay, so we had one group who was identified as now you are now a non-smoker, as if they like tapped them with like a wee little magic wand and said, poof, you are now a non-smoker. And this group was said, you are a group who's trying to quit. Now, obviously, they didn't know that this was the variable, but that was the variable. And what they found is that seeing themselves as a non-smoker decreased cravings. They no longer viewed themselves as a smoker. They literally changed all these other behaviors, like for example, taking the how they would take breaks, how they would, how they what they would do after a meal. They started to change all these other behaviors that were no longer compatible with behaviors of a smoker because they internalized the identification of I'm somebody who doesn't smoke versus the group who was trying to cut back, quit. They struggled deeply with cravings, really trying to dial in the behaviors around the smoking behavior. They really, really struggled. So there's an identity piece that is so important as well when we think about habits. I am a person who does this, and we do it consistently to the point that then we start to do it in a way that starts to feel automatic. I hope this is making sense. Now, a couple other kind of pieces that I just want to share with you. There's a wee bit of misinformation about how long does it take to create a habit. Now, you've probably heard 21 days before, or perhaps you've heard the new one, which is like 21 days for a new habit and 90 days for a lifestyle. I just want to hold space to recognize that is all averages, and not all behaviors and habits fit into that schedule. Okay. And what I mean by that is there's some habits that you can create very, very quickly. Like, I mean, like within a day or two, like you can create habits very, very fast. And there's other habits that could take up to 200 days. It could take multiple trials and repetitions to be able to create that as a consistent habit. So when we talk about 21 or 90 or the 3-3-3 rule, I just want to hold space to recognize those are all averages. Right, those are averages. It's the same, for example, when we think about we talked about this before about New Year resolutions, and folks have these New Year resolutions, and we know that usually, I believe it's been identified as January 18th is quitting day. That by that point, 66% of people have quit the habit or behavior that they had set the intention at New Year's to be able to change. So again, we know that these are averages because there's going to be people who quit before the quit day, and there'll be people who carry on a wee bit longer. And then there's some people who have adopted these new practices and they carry them into the future. Okay, so when we think about this idea, the biggest takeaway on that notion about the averages is usually the there was a study done in 2009 when it looked at the vast majority of health behaviors. They identified that as around 66. Okay, so that was the average that they put in that research around health behaviors. But again, what you're doing is you're creating routines, rituals, practices, familiarity, creating that sense of automation, the sense of mastery, and also if you're starting to identify, right? You're starting to see this as I am somebody who does this behavior, right? So, for example, I always use this one when I'm working with groups. I'm somebody who drinks coffee. I love a great cup of coffee. I don't need to write it on a to-do list. I've never written on a to-do list, hey, don't forget to drink coffee tomorrow. Sometimes I go to bed excited that I get to have coffee in the morning, right? So it's a very ingrained practice that I do. So again, understanding just familiarity, exposure to it. To circle back just for a moment on cell phones, there was an interesting piece of research that just came out that said the average parent or the average grown-up looks at their cell phone 262 times a day. Isn't that wild that we pick up and look at our cell phones 262 times a day? And again, my friends, that's the average, which means there's people that are looking at it even more than that. Now, just last week, I happened to be in Whistler, and it was a great group of educators, and this very well-intended educator was expressing their concerns about teenagers and their cell phone use. And I totally get it. There's so much research already coming out. We know this is a big deal. And he asked me, what do we do about this? Like, well, how do we get these teenagers off the phone? And in that moment, I just, again, yes, I know that there is enormous amounts of research that's talking about the hours of screen time and how it impacts mental health. I get that. But what's fascinating in that moment, what came to me in terms of how do I want to respond and show up for this gentleman, is I said to him, I think really what we have to do is we need to look at our own behavior first. Before we start harping on these teenagers and on these kids with their screen time, I really think it's time as grown-ups, we actually look at our own behavior. And I could tell I don't think he particularly loved that answer. And I get that, and he's totally welcome within his purview not to like that answer. But the reason that came to my heart and to share with him was just the night before, Hunter and I, who happened to join me in Whistler, he and I were out for dinner, and there was this very young family, and there was a mom and a dad and these two littles. And what was so remarkable is the mom and the little girl went to use the restroom, and it was just dad and the little boy. And the little boy, I think he was probably about maybe, I'm guessing, 3 or 4. And the entire time that the other part of the family was absent from the table, the dad was on his phone. And the little boy had, played with his crayons, right? Those three proverbial crayons they all get and they all break. You know what I'm talking about? Those little menu crayon things. The little boy had played a little bit with his crayons, and then he, was actually playing with these little sugar packs, and he was moving things about. But I was just watching him. He kept on looking to his parent. He just kind of kept on looking at his dad, and his dad was buried in his phone. Then he kind of started playing with his napkins, and he was moving things about, and you just saw him there. And at one point, he was just kind of swinging his feet under the table. And what was amazing, he's swinging his feet on the table, and then one swing, he got pretty excited, and like he kicked the table and kind of banged the table. And the dad looked at him and was very cross with him about, telling him to be quiet and sit still. And then his dad went back to the phone, and the little boy sat there, and then he just like hoofed the table. And the dad looked at him and he's like, "What are you doing? I told you to sit still. And, your mom will be back in a minute. Just sit still, be quiet." And what was so remarkable, it was like, even though the little boy was getting negative attention, the fact that he was able to interrupt his grown-up on the cell phone, the little guy kept doing that behavior because he was willing to take, kind of a reprimand over then being ignored. And again, I'm not calling out that dad. He could have been navigating a big work issue or a medical issue or something on the phone, right? I want to hold space that you never know what's going on, and I'm outsider looking in on this situation. But it just reinforced to me this kind of idea that it's so easy to kind of point and say, oh, it's these kids on the phones these days, that's the problem. But again, if we see in the research that we know grown-ups are on their phone and looking at their phone 262 times a day, there's going to be consequences. And little ones are always watching, right? Little ones are always watching. Another time I remember somebody asking me, how do I get my kids to read, right? How do I get my kids to read and love reading? And I remember asking the parent, I'm like, "Well, do you read?" And they're like, "No, I'm not a really big reader." I'm like, "Oh, the easiest way to get your kids to read is for you to sit down and read, for you to have a book or your Kindle or something and talk about the books that you're reading." Like, children want to be part of, they want to jump into these experiences. And it's so much easier to invite people into the behaviors than try and stay on the outside and push them into behaviors. I hope that makes sense. Okay, two other kind of ideas that I wanted to share with you on habits. First of all, we want to make them obvious. We want to make them easy. They need to be attractive, and they also have to be somewhat satisfying. So what I love to think about is another practice to do that is something called habit stacking. And I'll share with you, I am like so appreciative for this practice called habit stacking because it has allowed me to unlock so many opportunities to add these positive as an additive habits into my day in such a simple way, the most economical way. So this is how habit stacking works. Take a habit you already have and then just put the new behavior on top of it. Here's an example. I already shared, I'm a big coffee drinker in the morning. It's one of my favorite hobbies. And what I love to do with my coffee is I pick up a hot cup of coffee anytime I hold a hot coffee, and I say to myself, what are three new behaviors, or sorry, three new things that I'm thankful for. So I'm pairing the habit of coffee with the habit I want to increase of gratitude. So I just put them together. So I hold that cup of coffee and I say, what are three new things that I'm grateful for today in this moment? And the key is the word new things. Because if we just kind of go through this laundry list of, I'm thankful for my health, I'm thankful for my family, I'm thankful for my finances, my faith. Like, if we just do it like a laundry list of transactions, it doesn't land the same way as when we unlock the novelty effect of looking for the good in the day. That sense of newness, that fondness. So every time I hold a cup of coffee, I always say, what are three things I'm thankful for? So it's this amazing moment of mindfulness, of gratitude, and it feels so satisfying. I remember, and I've shared this before, one time Jack said to me when he was little, he goes, "Mama, you're the only one I know who like says grace over coffee." And I said, "Dude, I don't say grace over coffee. Like, I say great, we say grace over our meals, but not over coffee." And he goes, "No, Mom." He's like, "You do this thing where you get this cup of coffee, you close your eyes." He's like, "You just kind of like, all of a sudden your shoulders drop and you exhale and you smile and then you drink your coffee." And I said, "Oh, Jax, that's not grace. I'm using habit stacking. I want to build the practice of gratitude. So I just always remind myself and look for three new things that I'm grateful for. And Jack said to me, "Isn't that what grace is?" Oh, I tell you, that little guy. So yeah, maybe I do say grace over coffee. Let's give you some other examples of habit stacking. So another one could be, I do this one as well. Every time I click my seatbelt, every time I put on a seatbelt, whether I'm driving a car or if I'm a passenger in the car, I always just take a moment and just, acknowledge that I'm about to operate a motor vehicle, or I'm about to be in a motor vehicle as a passenger, and I want to be present and I just want to be in the moment. The reason I share that is I have talked to so many people who have experienced pretty substantive car accidents. And so often I hear this theme of that they just weren't paying attention, that they were on autopilot. They were going through the motions. And because so many of us who are frequent drivers, we've experienced this level of mastery with driving that, like, sometimes you can, like, all of a sudden notice, like, wow, I made it home. I hope I made good choices while I was driving, because you doesn't even feel like you're paying attention. So just by putting that seatbelt on, bringing my awareness to the present situation, and just really holding space for the responsibility of operating motor vehicle, is a habit stack that I find extremely helpful. Just as another little kind of tie in there, when you think about that growth of the habit, if you happen, for example, to be somebody who drives manual transmission, do you remember when you first started driving and learning? You probably were stalling out. You're trying to remember all the moving parts with pushing down the clutch, easing up on the clutch, the gas, all the things. But when you experience mastery, it's like it's automatic. You don't even you can put your car in gear and you move through all the different traffic experiences and you don't really even have to think about it. That's what autopilot tends to look like. And I also still remember one time Ava saying to me when I was driving a manual vehicle, she's like, "Mom, when you grow up, will you learn how to drive automatic like the other mothers?" And don't worry, Ava, I've got that covered. I can drive both. Okay. One little last takeaway for you. I want to land this plane. I want to share something that I have found super helpful in terms of my habit of completing tasks while I'm in a work day. All right. I have used this practice for quite a while and it's become a habit. And it wasn't until somebody specifically asked me about how I structure some of my work day did I realize that this habit could maybe help other people. So I want to share it with you here. I call it 3-2-1, because it's simple and easy to remember. When I'm building a work day, and I don't do this every single day that I'm working, because sometimes I'm on the road, or sometimes I'm traveling, or sometimes I'm speaking or running, different types of events. But when I'm having just a work day, how I do my 3-2-1 is I spend the first part of the day 3 hours on the most important task. And this is like, I create this like bunker around myself when I'm doing this task. I mean, no notifications. The email hasn't even been opened. The phone isn't even in the room with me. Like, I literally create this bunker of 3 hours of uninterrupted time on task, deep focus. This is where I'm writing the books. This is where I'm working with the research. Like, I will go into this 3 hour window. Thank you, Dr. Maria Montessori, for teaching us the power of a 3 hour window. So I use this 3 hour window. Then I will have usually 2 hours for what I call this idea about like short maintenance activities. So that could be email, that could be just, again, quick, short little tasks, updating some slides, sharing a few pieces of information, and maybe a little bit on social media. So I set aside 2 hours for like transactions. Right, those simple short tasks. And then I spend 1 hour of learning, connecting, or growing. And what I mean by that, I'm either reading a new piece of research or learning about a new concept, or I'm learning, I'm elevating, leveling up, skilling up, practicing new sets of skills. So in that 1 hour a day when I'm having a work period, I'm going to spend an hour in some form of growth. That could also come from a conversation. That could become talking to somebody, being able to, whether it be a coach, whether it be another business partner, like just really talking about something around elevation, skilling up, leveling up. And I find that those days where I have 3 hours of deep work, 2 hours of short tasks of transaction tasks and 1 hour of learning, connecting, or growing, those days are so wildly productive. It makes it so the time that I'm on the road, the time that I'm traveling, doing other things, like I can just focus on those things because I know those work days, those days that I structure in my 3-2-1 day, I'm going to move mountains in those windows of time because it's so ingrained. It's a habit for me that this is where I can get great work done. So 3-2-1, having a few 3-2-1 days on work days can be extremely helpful. Now, just to also tie in there, in though that 2 hour transactions, that's where I might have a few meetings, pre-event calls, or a few different kind of contact points, but that's different than the 1 hour that I make sure that I'm inspired, growing, learning skills. And what I find is all three of those types of those three structures, right? Those three different types of work fuel my brain in different ways, right? And our buddy Dr. Greg, he's the one who can explain how, you know, that morning work is that beta brainwave work, the alpha brainwave work. And again, I'm activating different parts of my brain. So when it's finished, oh my gosh, when it's finished, I feel so productive. I'm well resourced for the task at hand. So that's called my 3-2-1. I'm a huge advocate of that. It's something that I find super helpful. The last little bit, okay, I think I said my last little bit, but this is my next last little bit. When you're thinking about new behaviors, the closer that I'll give you, I call it the three R's. The three R's is set a reminder, have the routine, and reward yourself very quickly. So reminder, routine, reward, the three R's. So if this is the only part of the podcast that you take away, just take a moment. Okay, if I want this new behavior in my life and I'm going to do it one behavior at a time, I'm going to have a reminder. I'm going to have the very clear routine, whatever it is, and I'm going to reward the heck out of it. Not after, but during, like everything about it. Already start giving yourself hype. Like already start cheering yourself because you're in the right direction of doing it. I hope that helps, my friends. That is a lot of information coming at you. I could hot talk about habits for days. So if you have any questions, wonderments, or curiosities, please, please, please continue to reach out. I love answering your questions. If you want more specifics, if you whatever you need, oh my gosh, I'm here to be useful. And my last little thanks, I do want to hold space to say thank you to everyone who joined me at the Stress Wisely Lab last week. It was so special to be in community, to be able to have like 90 minutes uninterrupted time just to be present, to be in community with each and every one of you who joined. So thank you for people who made time for that. Hope this episode was helpful, and I look forward to connecting with you again super soon. Take good care, everyone. Bye for now. Thank you for spending time with this podcast episode today. I hope you found something helpful in Resiliency Redefined. Please feel free to share it with somebody who you might think could benefit. Maybe there was something useful, something in particular that you think you could pay forward. Also, if you have a moment, please feel free to rate and review this podcast wherever you like to listen to your podcast. It means the world to me. And again, thanks for your time. Thank you for your interest. Take good care, and I'll see you next time.